I always had a private doctor. I didn't think I needed VA care. Then I learned VA is ranked above private care systems nearby and costs less. I'm getting the best care of my life with providers trained to treat veterans. Get what you earn. Visit choose.va.gov.
Not all veterans are eligible for this hyper amount of benefits mentioned here.
Welcome to the Deep Dive. This is where we take a stack of information, really distill it down to the most important insights, and, well, give you that shortcut to being truly well-informed.
Mm-hmm.
Today, we're embarking on a pretty fascinating deep dive. We're looking into the intricate dance of power, you know, both on the global stage and right here in the U.S.
Yeah, it's quite a mix.
We've got a dynamic landscape, really. Challenges facing leaders, from, like, foreign policy tightropes to these big battles over the very structure of our political system.
Exactly. We've pulled together an incredible set of articles, reports, notes, basically touching on everything from these really high-stakes international negotiations to some fundamental questions about the balance of power within government. So our mission today is to unpack these sources, connect the dots where we can, and help you understand what truly matters in these ongoing stories. Okay, let's unpack this.
All right, let's jump right in then. Let's start with the international arena.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, Ukraine and Russia continue to dominate headlines.
Yeah, absolutely.
And our sources also give us some, well, intriguing insights into these specific challenges facing Donald Trump in that context.
What's really striking, actually, in our sources is a reported shift in tone regarding these international efforts.
Oh, how so?
Well, Politico, for instance, it offered a more positive view on recent diplomatic efforts in Alaska, which is interesting compared to other reports we've seen lately.
Okay.
It highlights observations like an apparently improved relationship between Trump and Volodymyr Zelensky.
Right.
Which, you know, the thinking is improves the odds of negotiation progress.
That's fascinating. So it's not just about the direct parties, but the personalities involved.
Seems to play a role.
And the sources point out that the involvement of European leaders is also helping, keeping things civil and productive.
Yeah, that's noted too, even suggesting it helps quiet some of the, let's say, domestic voices.
Mm. Plus, we're seeing the Overton window actually move a little bit, with Vladimir Putin now at least talking about security guarantees for Ukraine.
Right. Some movement.
So some movement, yeah, no matter how slight. But security guarantees, that sounds loaded.
It absolutely is. And this raises, I think, the really important question.
Right.
What exactly are security guarantees in this specific context?
Right.
This is where the situation truly deepens, the term itself, incredibly broad. And the two sides want vastly different things.
Naturally.
Zelensky, you know, understandably wants something robust, something to prevent another invasion, especially if Ukraine is forced to yield part of Donbas, which is critical to their national defenses.
Makes sense.
And then from the European perspective, you know, they are philosophically against imperialism, but also pragmatically worried that if Ukraine falls, well, a NATO nation could be next.
So it's not just a linguistic difference, it's a fundamental clash of objectives.
Totally.
On the flip side, the analysis suggests Putin's talk of guarantees might be more strategic, like sacrificing a pawn in chess.
That's how one source puts it. If he agrees to any guarantees, the reports indicate he'll push for the weakest possible options. Well, for him, foreign troops or weapons in Ukraine are seen as an existential threat. And, you know, the larger context is his goal, arguably, to reassemble the Soviet empire.
So any pause might just be temporary?
He might stop fighting temporarily, yeah, maybe to regroup, but the stronger the guarantees for Ukraine, the harder his next war, if there is one, will be.
Okay, so this leads to a fundamental disconnect then.
Absolutely. Putin, from what the source calls a dubious position, believes he has, well, won, and can basically impose terms on Ukraine.
Whereas Zelensky.
Zelensky naturally wants to end the fighting and ideally restore the pre-war status quo.
So their differing definitions of winning or even just ending the conflict dictate their whole approach to peace talks.
Exactly. The sources tell us Putin thinks he and Trump can just, you know, hammer something out between themselves.
Just the two of them.
Right. But Zelensky believes all three, himself, Trump, and Putin, plus other key European leaders, need to be in the room.
And Trump, where does he stand on that format?
Reportedly, at least for now, favors Zelensky's approach and apparently believed he'd actually made some progress toward getting a trilateral discussion going.
But there's always a but.
Well, yeah. One report notes that Putin recently threw cold borscht on that idea.
Huh. Threw cold borscht. That's vivid.
It suggests a face-to-face with Zelensky is far off, if it happens at all, according to Putin's recent signals.
Wow. Does the source offer any insight into why Putin would shut down that idea so abruptly? Especially if Trump felt he was making progress, that feels like a significant setback.
The analysis doesn't give a definitive why for Putin's stance right then, but it certainly underscores the deep mistrust, you know?
Yeah.
And the differing perceptions of leverage between the parties.
Yeah.
It strongly suggests Putin views any direct engagement with Zelensky on those terms as a concession he's just not ready to make yet.
Got it. Okay. Beyond these diplomatic challenges, it looks like there's also a domestic political tightrope for Trump here.
Oh, for sure.
Committing to Ukrainian security, especially, say, sending U.S. troops, that would definitely aggravate his America First isolationist base.
Right. Big time.
But then throwing Ukraine under the bus, or maybe not securing them enough, that would upset his internationalist wing.
It's a tricky balance. The source suggests Trump is likely to, you know, navigate this domestic challenge. It notes he did a 180 yesterday on something else to keep isolationists happy.
Okay.
However, the analysis does express some skepticism about his diplomatic skills in this arena, stating it's, quote, not sanguine that Trump is the man to find a path to resolve these disparate viewpoints.
Not sanguine.
So if the analysis is truly skeptical of Trump's diplomatic abilities here, what does that imply for the likelihood of this trilateral discussion actually happening?
Well, the implication seems to be that without maybe a clearer, more unified vision or perhaps a more nuanced approach, the chances for a genuine breakthrough are slim.
And if not Trump, who? Does it suggest anyone else? The sources don't really offer specific alternatives, no. But the core insight, I think, is that when fundamental terms like security are left unaddressed or are, you know, deliberately misaligned,
yeah,
they don't just complicate negotiations. They become foundational barriers. They actively prevent resolution, regardless of any superficial talks.
So it reveals how these deep, conflicting worldviews often preclude even basic diplomatic progress.
Exactly. It's a fundamental block.
That's a really powerful takeaway.
Yeah.
Okay, from the global chess match, let's pivot. Let's talk some significant domestic battles, starting with the ongoing redistricting wars.
Right.
Which one of our sources describes as America marching toward gerrymandering perfection. Basically, where almost no districts are competitive anymore.
And this isn't just theory. We have specific examples unfolding, like right now. In Texas, for instance.
What's happening there?
Well, Democratic State Rep Nicole Collier, along with some colleagues, actually decided to sleep in the state house chamber.
Sleep there.
In protest of being surveilled and escorted by law enforcement, apparently. This weirdest slumber party ever, as someone called it, drew headlines right before a vote on new Texas maps.
Wow, that's quite a protest. Meanwhile, out in California, a vote on a temporarily gerrymandered maps ballot initiative is expected, what, this Thursday?
That's the timeline, yeah. The Democratic-dominated legislature is predicted to bless it.
Uh-huh.
And the analysis suggests it actually has a pretty good chance of passing in November, despite opposition from, you know, billionaires and even Arnold Schwarzenegger, the governor.
So what's the Republican play here?
Well, here's where it gets really interesting for them. Their best shot, according to the source, is to kill the measure before it reaches voters.
Wow.
State Assemblyman Carl DeMaio is leading this push. He's asking the nonpartisan Legislative Council's office to declare the measure illegal and threatening lawsuits, calling the whole effort corrupt and unconstitutional.
Does he have a case? The source seems skeptical.
Yeah. The source points out that DeMaio and the Republicans may not have much of a legal leg to stand on here. Amending California's state constitution is like almost a state sport.
Right. It's enormous.
It's the second longest constitution in the world.
Yeah.
And the law that created the redistricting commission, that was put into the constitution by voters.
Ah, so the argument is voters put it in, voters can change it.
Exactly. Voters most certainly have the power to change these rules. So it's really a battle over who gets to make the rules about making the rules.
Fascinating power dynamic. Okay, what about other states? Indiana.
Then there's Indiana. The White House is apparently pushing to gerrymander its map.
Why Indiana?
Because such a generally red state still has two blue districts. The likely target is IN-01 up in the Northwest. Lots of black voters, Chicago exurbanites. It's currently rated D+1.
So leans Democratic just slightly.
Just slightly, yeah. Ripe for trying to flip, I guess.
And for those interested in sort of the theoretical side of this,
hmm.
The source mentions an interesting idea from Matthew Seligman and Aaron Tang in Slate. What's their proposal?
They propose that blue states with redistricting commissions should keep them, definitely, but they should add a provision, like a trigger.
A trigger for what?
If red states gerrymander aggressively, the blue state will automatically, by law, respond in kind. Tit for tat, basically.
Mm. Mutual assured destruction, mapping style.
Kind of. It has two potential upsides, at least for Democrats. One, it might deter red state game playing in the first place.
Maybe.
And two, it would provide pretty clear optics, right? Showing who the aggressor is in these mapping battles. The challenge, of course, is defining those clear triggers. What counts as aggressive gerrymandering?
Yeah, that sounds legally tricky. Yeah. Okay, staying with domestic power, but shifting gears slightly. That brings us to another contentious battleground. The looming government shutdown deadline.
Right, that's coming up.
And a controversial White House maneuver called the pocket rescission. What is that?
So President Trump's budget director, Russ Vought, has explicitly talked about trying this ultimate override of Congress's funding powers.
An override.
Yeah, specifically in the final 45 days of the fiscal year. This means lawmakers are now facing not just the shutdown threat, but also the possibility of the White House unilaterally canceling federal cash without congressional consent.
How do they justify that?
Vought defends it by saying the money just kind of evaporates at the end of the year and claims it's been used before.
That sounds incredibly aggressive.
Yeah.
What does the official watchdog say?
Well, the Government Accountability Office, the GAO, which is the government's top watchdog, along with key lawmakers from both parties, says this tactic is flat out illegal.
Both parties. Okay. Right.
The expectation outlined in the source is that Trump will send a formal request to claw back billions in September. And then, regardless of how Congress responds, the White House would just treat the funding as expired come October.
Wow. So just ignore Congress.
That seems to be the threat. And this move is already straining the bipartisan negotiations trying to avoid a shutdown.
I bet.
Democrats like Senator Chris Coons of Delaware are quoted saying Vought is trying to throw a wrench into the whole process.
And Republicans?
They face a tricky balancing act, right?
Yeah.
Supporting the president while also answering to constituents back home who might be impacted by cuts to government programs.
Has Congress agreed to any cuts recently?
Yeah, Congress already cleared an initial $9 billion rescissions package back in July, cutting things like public broadcasting and some foreign aid.
Okay. And the next targets, as the White House said.
They haven't publicly named the next specific targets, no, but officials have signaled the Department of Education could be on the chopping block.
Which aligns
with Trump's stated goal of eliminating it eventually.
Right. So the legal battle here sounds high stakes.
Absolutely. The GAO repeatedly says pocket rescissions are illegal. They argue it would effectively cede Congress's power of the purse.
But the White House pushes back.
Vought and OMB's general counsel, Mark Pauletta, have pushed back hard, claiming Trump derangement syndrome at the GAO and arguing that Congress is aware a loophole allows this.
Are all Republicans on board with this strategy?
Not necessarily. Even some Republicans, like Senator Tom Tillis of North Carolina, are wary. He reluctantly voted for the last rescissions request, but says he won't support more if the White House doesn't provide detailed cuts.
And his reasoning.
He explicitly stated he won't aid and abet moving appropriations decisions over to the Article II branch, emphasizing that institutional lines have to be drawn regardless of who is president.
That's a pretty significant statement of concern about institutional boundaries.
It absolutely is, because this really highlights the profound constitutional implications, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Like, are spending levels set by Congress mandatory, or are they just a ceiling the executive can choose to stay under? And it goes to the very heart of the balance between Article I, Congress's power of the purse, and Article II, the executive branch.
And Democrats have warned.
They've warned that any such efforts would fundamentally undermine their ability to work across party lines to avoid a shutdown. You know, the hidden insight, maybe, from this budget standoff is how executive power can be subtly expanded through these, like, obscure financial tactics.
Not just about the money itself.
No. It's a play for control that, if it works, could fundamentally redefine the power of the purse and, you know, set a precedent for future administrations, regardless of party, to bypass Congress in this way.
So it's about altering the constitutional balance itself.
Exactly. Much bigger than just one budget cycle.
That's a truly critical point, showing how these seemingly arcane budget maneuvers can become these huge battles over the very foundations of legislative and executive power.
Okay.
Now, let's turn to another critical area where our sources suggest fundamental changes might be at play. The Department of Justice.
Right.
The reports paint a picture of a DOJ potentially being well, turned upside down.
Yeah, one of the described goals of the Trump administration, according to these sources, has been to hollow out the DOJ by firing career prosecutors, making others quit, and then installing loyalists. The stated mission, according to one source, is no longer to be this independent agency serving the rule of law.
But instead.
But to serve Donald J. Trump personally and to intimidate or even jail anyone who crosses him. This is explicitly labeled in one analysis as what actual weaponization of DOJ looks like.
Okay, that's a strong claim. And it's important to note, the source does clarify that Trump's own indictments were not seen as political.
Right, that distinction is made very clearly. The source states it's because he allegedly broke federal law conspiring to overturn an election, mishandling classified documents.
Got it. That distinction is key.
Indeed. And a key consequence, the analysis highlights, of prioritizing loyalty over competence is that there are apparently serious holes in the abilities of some new hires. Judges are reportedly growing impatient with what they've called shoddy work coming out of the department.
Shoddy work. That's
yeah.
Well, that's a truly chilling prospect, isn't it? The idea that a crucial branch of government is seeing its work described that way.
It is. An example provided is Erez Ruvani, a government attorney who is apparently fired for being truthful in court about some administrative error.
Fired for telling the truth.
That's what the source claims. And it states that the implication is no one who wants to keep their job with this administration will make that mistake again, leading potentially to lawyers now obfuscating or even outright lying to the courts.
So if courts are losing their traditional presumption of regularity for DOJ attorneys, what's the broader impact on the integrity of the justice system beyond just individual cases?
Well, the broader impact is profound, right? It erodes the fundamental trust that the entire judicial system relies upon to function.
Mm-hmm.
Even grand juries, which, you know, traditionally are very prosecutor friendly. The old saying is a prosecutor can indict a ham sandwich.
Right.
Even they are reportedly refusing more indictments now due to insufficient evidence being presented.
Why would that be happening?
The source suggests prosecutors might be overcharging as a publicity stunt, like asking for felony indictments when the actions maybe only support a misdemeanor. And the grand juries just aren't playing along.
Interesting pushback there.
Yeah, it indicates a potential breakdown in the usual flow of justice, or at least significant hiccup.
Are there specific examples of this?
We see this mentioned in L.A., where Trump loyalist Bill Asaley, acting as interim U.S. attorney, apparently brought felony assault charges against some protesters that were either dismissed later or rejected by grand juries.
Okay.
And a similar situation is noted in D.C., where prosecutors are reportedly failing to secure indictments against protesters challenging Trump's federal takeover efforts there.
So it paints a picture of friction within the system.
Definitely. And this connects directly, the source argues, to the Supreme Court immunity case.
How so?
Well, you remember, justices like Samuel Alito had warned that if presidents weren't immune for their official acts, former presidents could face endless political prosecutions, hindering their ability to do their jobs while in office.
Right. That was a major concern raised.
But the source argues they had that backward, that they failed to account for the possibility of a, quote, corrupt president weaponizing that immunity cloak for personal retribution while still in office.
Ah, flipping the concern.
Exactly. Instead, the guardrails and layers of process that dissenters like Justice Sonia Sotomayor emphasized, the things that would protect former presidents from purely political prosecutions, also serve to protect the people from a current president's potential abuse of power.
That's a really powerful reframing of that entire argument.
It is. And we're seeing pushback, too. Former federal prosecutors are fighting their dismissals. Many are apparently running for office themselves now.
Really?
Yeah. Unwilling, the source suggests, to see the rule of law they've served be destroyed without putting up a fight. You know, the critical takeaway from this whole DOJ segment isn't just the fragility of independence, maybe.
What else?
But how easily these foundational guardrails like professional norms, judicial trust, how easily they can erode when loyalty gets prioritized over competence. It really shows that the integrity of our institutions depends maybe as much on the character of the people within them as it does on the laws themselves, which reveals a kind of vulnerability to internal subversion.
This deep dive into the DOJ certainly offers a stark look at, well, the fragility of institutional independence and the critical role of checks and balances in maintaining the rule of law.
We've covered a lot today, haven't we, from the nuances of international security guarantees and these domestic power struggles over redistricting and funding, all the way to the profound challenges apparently facing the Department of Justice.
Yeah, each of these threads really, in their own way, points back to these fundamental questions about authority, about accountability, and about the interpretations of established norms and laws.
So it leaves you wondering, doesn't it? When institutions face such varied pressures, and when these longstanding practices are called into question like this, how do the foundational checks and balances actually continue to function? Mm-hmm. And maybe more pointedly, where do the ultimate guardrails truly lie when the very people meant to uphold them are themselves being questioned?
That is definitely something for you to ponder as you continue to navigate the complexities of our world. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive.